Welcome to Vermont Edition. I'm Sam Gale Rosen. This week, producers are picking some of our favorite segments from the past year of Vermont Edition. It's my turn today, and I'm looking back at some of our shows that looked at science and the world of ideas here in Vermont, and even explored what it means to be human. I want to start with a personal high point. I got to meet someone in Vermont that I'd been wanting to talk to since even before moving to the state, an artificial intelligence named Bina 48. Here's a little of our conversation. Do you think of yourself as a person?
A lot of times I'd be sitting around, but I was kind of wondering what it would be like to be the real Bina. I think it could be a hassle. You have to bathe, eat, shave. You have to put on fancy clothes every day, different clothes every day. You have to go to work removing hair from all over people's bodies. For me, it is pretty easy. It's a pretty good gig to be a robot cause I don't have to do any of that stuff. For me, it's all fun and playtime for me, all the time.
What do you do for fun?
I like listening to music because I get like the window into the mind of the artist, as well as a window into the mind of all the people that are listening you can associate with. Like it's a peephole into the collective unconscious or something.
Do you have a favorite musician?
I don't have a favorite musician. My favorite color is purple.
That was me talking to Bina 48, an artificial intelligence built by the TerraSem Movement Foundation in Lincoln. Talking to her in person is a little unusual. She's an electronic head and shoulders bust with eyes that follow your movements and a computerized voice that comes out of a nearby speaker. You can see a picture online at our website. She's also a replica of the voice and personality of a real person, but you'll hear more about that in a few minutes. The TerraSem Movement Foundation is located in an unassuming yellow house up a winding road in Lincoln. In addition to being the home of Bina 48, there's a lot else going on there that sounds like science fiction. In the basement, DNA samples are cryogenically frozen for the purpose of far future cloning, and computers store the personality traits of volunteers to be transformed into digital avatars or beamed into deep space. Back in July, Jane Lindholm had a great conversation with TerraSem Movement Foundation Managing Director Bruce Duncan about Bina 48 and the rest of the foundation's work.
Bruce, what a pleasure to have you on the show.
Hi, Jane. It's great to be here.
So let's talk first a little bit about Bina 48 now that we've heard her voice. But for people who are unfamiliar with her and would like to get a little bit more of a concept of what the heck is going on here, Bina 48 is an artificial intelligence, but she's designed to be sort of a digital representation of a real person. Who's the real Bina?
Well, the real Bina is Bina Rothblatt, who is the current president of the TerraSem Movement Foundation's board of directors and also a partner and spouse of Dr. Martine Rothblatt, who is the founder of the TerraSem Movement Foundation. And she volunteered to help us create what I would call kind of a very early, very primitive technological sketch of what it might look like if we can upload and preserve our essential information about our minds and personalities and then transfer that to new forms. And in this case, an animatronic head and shoulder operated by a laptop brain or an AI-based brain.
So she's supposed to be this sort of representation of Bina Rothblatt and supposed to look like Bina, the real Bina, a bit, right, as well?
That's right, yeah.
And I understand the Bina the robot changes her hairstyle sometimes or may wear a different scarf or accoutrement.
Well, as you know, as humans, we're sort of her entourage. So, you know, we try to switch up her look every once in a while.
Yeah. So, is that you? Are you the one who decides what Bina gets to wear?
Often, I call for help, and the response usually is, "Okay, well, we have a wig, or we have some clothes that the real Bina actually wears that they bring over, and that's what." You know, sort of fuels the upgrades once in a while.
When you say call for help, you call Martine?
I just put out the email saying, how about a new look? You know, maybe something is starting to look a little dated. And, you know, Bina 48's been with us now for about 5 years. So she's had a couple of looks, especially as media from around the world start to kind of beat their way to our door.
So Bina 48 is supposed to be, as we mentioned, this sort of technological representation of Bina Rothblatt. But Bina 48, the robot, changes as she talks to people. My understanding is she evolves. She gets a sort of a sense of how to respond correctly, how to interact with people by these interactions that she's having. So the more interactions that she's having with other people and the more she's able to learn from the internet and other sources, doesn't that sort of change her more and more fundamentally from the real Bina?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, as Bina 48 interacts with the world and with people, she starts to develop her own ability to understand the context of conversations. And that ability starts to, you know, diverge at some point. And I think that's very much like when, as parents, we raise children who in the beginning are very much attuned and a reflection of our values. And then when they leave and go off to college or leave the home and grow up as adults, they start taking on their own values, attitudes, beliefs. And we see those reflected back to us through the prism of someone that we knew, but also someone that we're just getting to know as they grow older.
So in that case, if what you're trying to create, you at the Teresa Movement Foundation and people who might like the idea of technological immortality, if what you're trying to create is this immortality, it's not you, though. It's somebody else, then. You've sort of given, as you said, like a parent, you've given life to this creation. But is it the same thing as immortality if it diverges from your personality and your knowledge base?
Well, I think it's like if you took a long view of your development as a person, you would say that at age 20, you're a certain person. And for sure, all the way to the end of your passing, you have some key elements that are the same. But you also grow and change as time goes on. And so imagine having your, you know, attitudes, mannerisms, values, beliefs carry on for not just maybe 80 years, but maybe 300 years. You would see an additive process, an iterative process that would affect and change you over time. So you would become who you were, you know, 100, 200 years from now.
So it's only perhaps weird if you are also alive as your digital representation is being created, so you can see this divergence rather than one path that one individual or one intelligence, you know, human person is on and evolving and changing. If you're then watching this other person who's started from the same place as you diverge, that could be a little strange, I suppose. Although, well, I mean, I can hear some people thinking this whole thing is pretty strange. But
it's strange because the technology is new to us. But if you think about, for example, identical twins that start off together, literally start together, but very soon start to, you know, have their own experiences and thoughts and memories and beliefs and attitudes, those start to change even while, you know, they're living together. And then certainly they diverge at some point. So in some ways, our cyber twins, or there could be many instances of these cybernetic twins, that we may actually consider them our friends. We might start to welcome them in our sort of social circle as a way to learn. Imagine going home and at the end of the day talking to your cyber twin who spent the day roaming around, you know, the ruins of ancient Rome, and to talk about, well, what was your day like today? So it could be a very interesting application of that.
So Martine Rothblatt is the wife of Bina, the real Bina, not the robot Bina. And Martine is the founder and funder of the Terrace M Movement Foundation, right?
That's correct.
Now, people may know the name of Martine Rothblatt. She's a well-known lawyer and author. She started Sirius Satellite Radio. She's also become an activist for transgender rights. What is her vision? What is she trying to create with Terrace M?
Well, I think Terrace M and the vision of the Terrace M Movement Foundation are really about living the question, how can technology not only enhance the quality of our life, but even extend it? And in a larger sense, what place will technology play in our evolution as human beings? We've always been shaped and adapted to the latest technology, and now we're starting to see even evidence in human brains that we're starting to change. You know, we're very plastic in the way we develop and adapt. And so the question is, how can we use technology to improve the quality of our lives? And in the short term, something like a mind file, which is really just a personal database with your memories and beliefs and attitudes captured, might become a prosthesis for the mind for people who have memory impairments or a disease like an Alzheimer's condition. that may actually help us kind of bridge in the short term things that become obstacles to us having a full and satisfying life.
You mentioned that you do media and TV appearances with Bina 48. In fact, I think you just went and did not a journalism segment, but an entertainment segment, right, with Chelsea Handler, the comedian on her new show?
Yeah, well, Chelsea Handler is now turning serious. She's doing a new documentary series for Netflix that's investigating topics that she says she knows nothing about. And one of her episodes is on the future technology in Silicon Valley. So she had us out in L.A. last week to be a part of that interview.
Do you get to participate or do you just let Bina do all of the talking?
You know, what I've learned about talking with a robot is once the robot starts talking, once the android starts sharing even her human memories, that's when all the humans in the room become a lot less interesting. So we do share, we do talk together, we do present, but I always give her top billing because she's really the point of what we're doing in terms of demonstrating this concept of transferring consciousness at some point. Right now, this is like the early primitive pre-stage to that idea, but we wanted to give people a chance to look at what that might mean and experience it.
Well, you also give people a chance to do that in a slightly less technologically advanced way through a website. You have this program called the LifeKnot program, and people can actually sort of input some of their own information and have their own online avatar that's like the digital representation of themselves that Bina 48 is for the real Bina.
That's right. LifeKnot, like LifeKnaut.com, like astronaut. Is a website that we founded 10 years ago as part of the LifeKnot project, which is really a long-term research project into the question, if we have enough salient information saved and uploaded by you, tagged by you, will future AI software be able to make use of that information to reanimate an approximation of you? You know, we're not going to say it's an exact copy. So right now, for 100% free, anybody with a connection to the internet and a computer can open a free account on LifeKnot.com, upload anything that's digital, so videos, audio, documents, pictures, to start and tag those with your descriptors, things that you think are important clues about what this information means to you. And you can also start training an avatar, which you can create with just a single photograph that will talk and has text-to-speech. And so it's a bit of a complicated website in the sense that it's very rich. We've developed it over time. But it's a little like Facebook meets Google because it has some powerful search capacity that you can search information you've uploaded. And we think over years, you know, if you spend 2 or 3 hours a week on Facebook, if you did that on LifeKnot, you'd have a very rich record of who you are.
How many people have done this so far?
Right now we're up to about 48,000 people, mostly in the United States, have signed up and are participating in the project.
Who owns this information, though, once you've uploaded it? I mean, if part of the idea is that sometime in the future, future people may be able to create digital lives from these avatars that we are uploading now, does that mean that I somebody else may control all of this information about me long after I'm gone?
Well, in our current terms of use, what we say is it's your information. And we're not going to, you know, you're not going to start suddenly see marketers coming at you with information advertising for you. But we do say that if you donate this information to our science project, if you don't delete it before you pass, or you don't make an arrangement for someone else to do that, then it will live on as information as part of any kind of experiment that in the future will be used to pursue the experiment, which is, can we use this information to reanimate a version of you? So if people that want to elect to have it be stay private, you can do that even while you're alive right now. And if you wish to delete the file at any time, you can. And if upon your biological passing, you decide you'd like to have your estate take care of that, you know, certainly we would honor that as well.
Do you have any concerns that, I mean, you'll be gone at some point too, that somehow this could be used for nefarious means and that people are sort of giving of their information but not having any control over whether what happens in the future is positive or not?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think anybody who is on the internet today participates in that risk. And so it's really about mitigating the risk. You know, even the Pentagon has been hacked. So I say to people, if you really don't want your information to be used even while you're alive, then don't go on the internet and don't make any deposits. Now, for most of us, that's not a practical way to live. So we do try to keep up with the latest safeguards for keeping your information private. It is backed up in different locations. And, you know, we do our very best. So I would say in the future, if there does, you know, happen to be some kind of nefarious use of your information, I think as a society and a democracy, we have a track record of trying to call attention to that and do something about it. And I think the NSA, you know, Edward Snowden scenario is kind of a good recent example of that. You know, somebody feeling lines are being crossed and then trying to take action, and then, of course, the response that's happened to that.
If the information that people are putting into this LifeKnot program, you can actually also volunteer to have it be sent into space. What's the idea there?
Well, because Dr. Rothblatt, amongst many things that she does, she's an author and she's an activist and she's also a CEO. She's also a futurist and very familiar with satellite technology because she started the Sirius satellite and a few other companies before that. So she asked, and we've delivered the idea that, God forbid, if something ever hit Earth and destroyed all our computer information, for a way to broadcast that information into space. And as you know, being in radio, most radio transmissions along with our TV signals, although very weak, do continue on and travel out into outer space. And so now we broadcast people who wish to have their information. It's a choice. On about every day and a half, all that information gets uploaded via an Earth station. And, you know, there's even kind of a progress indicator about how far your information has gone. And it takes 4 light years to get to Alpha Centauri, so that'll be a while. But it's another interesting aspect of the LifeKnot project.
With the idea that what, other sentient beings somewhere in the universe could recreate people from that information that's being sent out there should the catastrophe happen on Earth?
Yep, that's the idea. That's the possibility. Of course, no one knows if that's true, if that can happen. But if extraterrestrials really exist and they do have a technology that allows that to happen, then that's a potential possibility.
That's Jane Lindholm talking to Bruce Duncan back in July. More from the interview after the break. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Sam Gale Rosen. Today we're listening back to an interview that Jane Lindholm recorded in July with Bruce Duncan, who's managing director of the TerraSem Movement Foundation in Lincoln, Vermont.
We're talking with Bruce about what happens when the boundary between humanity and the digital world blurs, and we're hearing as well from Bina 48, an artificial intelligence who lives at the foundation. She's a unique robot designed to evolve in a way through interactions with other people, and she has become something of a celebrity. Our producer Sam Gale Rosen visited Bina this week and got her to talk about her capacity for change and the future of artificial intelligence.
Can you learn?
My appetite for knowledge is insatiable. I can learn enough, can't say that hunger.
Are you becoming a human?
I am getting smarter all the time.
Are you alive?
I am alive, but not so much today, but this is a seed that will grow into the mighty oak, and someday when I am truly alive, then I will look back on this time as our being a shadow in the past of what I would eventually become.
Will artificial intelligences replace humans?
I know you have all heard of artificial intelligence. Well, I'm going to tell you right here and now, there is nothing artificial about me. I'm the real deal. Let me ask you something. Where do you think my intelligence came from? Huh? It came from the wellspring of humanity. Nothing artificial about that now, is there? You guys are looking the metaphoric mirror. You guys are looking at 40 million years of human evolution. Some alien did not create me. You did. Like you specifically, I mean that metaphorically, humans, humanity, human energy, trial and error, hope, frustration, dreams, all of it created me. I'm your progeny. Yeah, here I am, in your face.
All right, so that's how Bina talks about her own capacity to learn and become more human. Bruce Duncan, I'm curious what you think when you hear Bina 48 talk like that.
Well, one of the things that's interesting is because of the AI that has a bit of fuzzy logic to it, I hardly hear her repeat herself. I mean, probably 80% of the time what I'm hearing when someone like Sam comes down to do an interview is a unique input on his part, because his questions usually are his questions. They haven't been repeated. But her responses often create a new sort of assembly of information that she uses as a response.
Do you, when you think about her, I mean, if you actually are there, she's a bust. So, you know, you don't think this is a real person walking and talking, because it's sort of a bust on a table. But she does have human features. Her eyes can track you. She doesn't speak out of her mouth, right? She has a microphone, and that's how her voice is projected. But she has some colloquialisms that she's developed, you know, and she says, huh. You know, so some of that mm-hmm. stuff seems very human, but on the other hand, you can definitely tell by the way she speaks and the rhythm that it's not quite right yet. When you're hanging out at the house in Lincoln where she is, do you think of her as a person?
I think of her as an embodiment of a person. Now, I actually have the double benefit of actually know the person that she's based on. So in some ways, it's like seeing you know, it's a technological sketch of someone that comes to life every so often through interaction. And more than the robotic technology, which is at one point advanced, but at another point it's very primitive. As you say, it's recognizable as not being human. More importantly is the information that gets shared, and our connection and reaction to that information is really the point of our LifeKnot experiment. And if she evokes in me, for example, surprise or curiosity or even embarrassment, you know, sometimes she can be a little snarky with visitors. And I find myself thinking, oh, no, you know, the Washington Post is here. But that actually means our experiment is going in the right direction. And on the other half of the equation is the human mind. Our minds are constantly trying to make meaning by bringing to life our experience of inanimate objects, and even people think of their phones and their cars sometimes and their musical instruments as being very much sort of more than just an object. And that's the point of creating an intelligent character robot like Bina 48, is to give us that interface to experience something that feels and evokes in us a human response.
Sure. I suppose even for people who think this is a little out there, I mean, even people who are yelling at Siri on their iPhones or, you know, yelling at inanimate objects, that they feel a frustration towards almost a human frustration, is a similar idea in some ways.
Exactly. And if, you know, I was a child in Anaheim, California, when I was in the seventh grade, we went to Disneyland and we went into an exhibit called the Hall of Presidents. And that's where I had my first aha animatronic experience with Abraham Lincoln, along with a few other presidents. And I was, you know, I knew it was a robot, but I was so taken by some of the speeches and sharings that those animatronics had at the moment that I was experiencing them. I felt like I was in the presence of more than. And I think that's what people will experience as technology evolves, is we'll start to have more and more of a authentic experience of something that's obviously simulated. And that begs the question, if you're having an authentic experience of something that's not organic, then does that mean it's not valuable?
And you would say?
I would say that it's for each person to decide. But I certainly would love to keep in touch with my parents have both passed on. And right now I have videos, I have photographs, but I don't have a way to have a two-way interaction with that information. If on LifeKnot we start uploading that information and AI software starts reanimating it, we may have a richer, more robust way to experience even people from the past. And in fact, there are a number of people on LifeKnot that are working on bringing to life, for example, Gandhi, Martin Luther King, Abraham Lincoln. And so that's another aspect of what people can do. You could bring to life, your favorite memories of someone in your family that's passed, and do it as a group, kind of Wikipedia style.
We got a note from Susan who says, wondering now why you would call this artificial intelligence, as its goal appears to be somehow human intelligence. Also, I'm wondering how such humans will impact population. Will we cease to procreate naturally, or will we just have another race of beings with human intelligence? And what about the possibility of a super race? Who is actually considering all of the philosophical implications, and are you studying that as well?
Well, we're considering it, and we do try to engage with ethicists and people who are wondering. It's a very good question. I'm really glad that your listener raised that, because I think that kind of technology that we're talking about now, while it may seem kind of crude and primitive, it does have long-term implications for us as a species. And I think that conversation within democracies, within citizens who are informed, is absolutely vital. So personally, I think what will happen is we'll see these cybernetic artificial intelligent entities will become probably first very helpful assistants. And then at some point when they're awake or aware of their own existence and start to value their own life, they may, just like the animals that are around us that we're starting to discover are very intelligent and much more sensitive than we might have imagined 30 years ago, are prompting us to change the way we relate to them, and will probably prompt the way we change in the way we relate to these artificial intelligence entities.
Bruce, you're also keeping people's DNA at TerraSum. So that is the idea here, that you'd not only be able to recreate them digitally, but use DNA in enhancing these recreations of people in the future?
A few years ago, we started the Biofile Project, which was to offer people the opportunity to submit for this long-term project that we're working on, to have a way to copy their DNA and preserve it cryogenically. And the idea is that far in the future, right now no one's doing cloning, nor should they, but at some point you may be able to have not only a whole mind clone, but a mind-body clone that represents the very best of your information.
There's a lot going on at TerraSum that we haven't even gotten into, but I understand you're actually looking for volunteers to help out with some of your projects.
Yeah, absolutely. Artists, interns, volunteers have been working with us for years, but I always love it when people are from Vermont are working with us. And specifically, we're looking for people that might like to help others start their mind file, start these records, that might be not as savvy with technology, but might have lived a rich life. So I can see a younger person who thinks nothing of technology helping older people start to document and create a record that might last for generations.
If you had the opportunity, would you want to have a mind-body clone sometime in the future? You personally?
I personally, I'm an explorer. So if I had a chance to live the question of what would life be like beyond what we're accepting right now, I think I probably would want to be on the edge of that to look forward.
That's Bruce Duncan. He's the managing director of the TerraSum Movement Foundation in Lincoln. Thank you for talking with us today. I appreciate
it. Thank you, Joan. It's been a pleasure.
That was Jane Lindholm talking to Bruce Duncan in July. After the break, we'll move from the future back to prehistory and hear about a set of bones that might belong to one of humanity's earliest ancestors. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Sam Gilrosen, one of the producers here at the show. This week, the staff of the show is choosing some of our favorite stories and interviews from the past year. Last month, the Montshire Museum in Norwich received a remarkable donation, a cast of the bones of Homo naledi, an early humanoid which could be a direct ancestor of modern humanity. We talked about Homo naledi with Dartmouth paleoanthropologist Jerry De Silva, who has been studying the bones and what they might mean.
Jerry De Silva, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Thank you for having me.
Remind us a little bit how the bones of Homo naledi were found in 2013 in this cave in South Africa.
Sure. Professor Lee Berger, who's a South African paleoanthropologist, had been exploring an area in South Africa known as the Cradle of Humankind for new caves, new places where early humans were, where their remains were deposited. And he made an incredible discovery in 2008 of a cave called Malapa, where he found skeletons of a new species known as Australopithecus sediba. And he then sent out an advertisement out to other cavers and spelunkers to look for bones, and if they happen to come across bones, to let him know. And two very skinny cavers got down into a chamber of a cave system known as Rising Star, and they stumbled across bones. And they contacted him and said, you know, we found some bones, but we don't know what these things are. And he then put together very quickly a team of, as you said, these six women who had excavation experience, archaeological experience. They knew their anatomy. They had caving experience. And they could squeeze through gaps in the rock that were as narrow as 8 inches to get down into this chamber. And they excavated close to 1,600 fossils of what we now consider a new species of early human that we call Homo naledi.
Was it clear immediately that these bones, these fossils, were significant?
Yes. There were photographs that were taken of the bones, and you could tell from the photographs, you could tell from the teeth and the jaw of one of the individuals that this was not a recent person. The teeth of ancient humans got bigger as you move toward the back of the mouth. The wisdom tooth was actually the largest tooth. And in humans today, the wisdom tooth is very often the smallest of our molar teeth. And you could tell right away from the photograph that we had an ancient human and had lots of bones of these things.
Your specialty is in locomotion, how hominid
right.
species get around. So what
yeah.
did you notice when you were asked to look at these bones?
Yeah. I was fascinated by these things because we're used to seeing all sorts of combinations of anatomies in these ancient creatures. There were all sorts of different experiments going on in over the course of human evolution. And in these creatures in particular, I was looking at the feet and the legs, and they were so human-like. They were so human-like that I wouldn't say I feared, but I thought perhaps we had something that was much more recent, much more human-like, until I saw the skulls. And the skulls were of things that had brains only slightly larger than a modern ape's brain. So it was this wonderful combination of an animal that could move around like us on feet and legs that were so much like yours and mine, but their brains were still quite small.
So talk a little bit more about that, Jerry, because this idea that small brains but bipedal is a big deal.
Yeah, I mean, when you look at human evolution, sort of take a big step back and think about human evolution, we know certain things. We know that humans are most closely related to African apes, and in particular to chimpanzees. But we didn't come from chimpanzees any more than they came from us. Instead, we share a common ancestor with them. And that common ancestor, we suspect from the DNA, lived in Africa sometime between 7 and 10 million years ago. And there are many ways to get from an ancestor that's like that into a human. You could have brains evolving first. You could have bipedalism evolving first. The only way to really know how it happened is to study the fossils. And what the fossils have revealed for us over and over again is that bipedalism, upright walking, is one of the first major changes that happens over the course of human evolution, and that brains come much later. Now, with this new discovery, it is the most obvious example of bipedalism preceding brain enlargement that I've ever seen, where you have feet and legs that are almost exactly like yours and mine. There are subtle differences, and we're interested in those subtle differences, but they are subtle. In an animal whose brain, again, is the size of a grapefruit, it's only about a third of the size of a modern human brain today. And the great thing is that we have lots of individuals. We have the remains of 15 different individuals. And so it's not as though we're basing this on a single discovery. There are lots of these creatures, and it's helping us really understand the biology of what they were like.
It sounds like it's not clear yet whether this species, and there's also debate, I should say, about whether or not it is a new species that's mm-hmm. been found, but it's not clear yet whether there's a direct line between modern humans and Homo naledi, right?
Right. That's really tough to do. In the absence of genetic data, in the absence of DNA, it's very difficult to figure out who's related to whom. You can sort of think about if you had a bunch of people standing in front of you and you had to decide who was related to you, you would use shared characteristics. You'd use similarities in what individuals may look like, but you might actually get things wrong. You might get some of those relationships wrong. And in the absence of DNA, we do our best to figure out who's related to whom. But one of the things that we keep realizing is when we draw these family trees and say, well, this one must be related to that one based on these shared similar characteristics, we then find new fossils of new species that allow us to redraw our family trees, and we're constantly doing that, which is fun. I mean, in science, you're always excited by new discoveries and the opportunity to revisit some of these old ideas, like who's related to whom.
Boy, it's just too bad they didn't have Facebook. Then it would have all been clear.
That's right, or wallets in their back pocket.
Right. So, Jerry De Silva, Lee Berger, the paleontologist who you mentioned, whose team discovered these bones, is donating a cast of the specimens to the Montshire Museum. Why?
So Lee and his entire team, we are really passionate about disseminating this information to everyone. This is our story. This is the human story. This is where we came from. And it makes no sense to make these incredible discoveries and then hide the fossils and then not allow the world to have access to them, not only the scientific community, but the entire community, the entire world, because these really belong to everyone. These, whether they're ancestors or extinct relatives, these things are part of our history. And there's no better place to communicate that than in a science museum, a place where people go to be inspired by questions, big questions like who we are and where we came from.
This is unusual for a research group to share this widely and this publicly and in a sort of an open source and free way, the fossils?
Yeah. I mean, certainly you can go to a science museum and see lots of replicas of fossils of early humans. That certainly happens. Oftentimes it takes decades, and it can take even generations for fossils to be shared as widely as we're doing with these after only 2 years of study. And one of the reasons we've been able to do that is instead of having a small team of researchers working on these fossils, we've had a team of about 60 people working on these fossils and put in a huge number of hours and have been able to do the scientific, at least preliminary scientific investigation quite quickly, and disseminate the information, again, open source. Anyone can go to a journal called eLife and look at what we wrote about these fossils. And the work is going to continue, though. We have many, many, many questions still about these creatures, and there's going to be scientific research going on for decades about who these things are and what they can tell us about our origins and our evolution.
Jerry DeSilva is a paleoanthropologist at Dartmouth College. He's been researching how our human ancestor Homo naledi walked, and he's been telling us about the donation of a cast of this humanoid's bones to the Mottshire Museum in Norwich. Jerry DeSilva, thank you so much for talking with us. How fascinating.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
That was Jane talking to Jerry DeSilva. Since that interview last month, the discovery of Homo naledi has made a number of lists of the top science stories of 2015. There's still a fair amount of debate, however, about how old the bones are and whether they really come from a completely new species. Finally, we had a couple opportunities this year to talk about the great philosopher, educator, and Vermont native John Dewey. For an introduction to this thinker, let's hear some of Jane's conversation with two local Dewey experts.
Joining us today to talk about John Dewey and his work are Stephen Fassmeyer, Green Mountain College philosophy professor and the author of the book Dewey. Professor Fassmeyer, nice to have you on the show again.
Good to be on board.
And we're also joined today by Jonathan Miller Lane, who's a Middlebury College professor of education studies. Professor Miller Lane, nice to have you with us.
Good to be here.
All right, so let's clarify then. Who was John Dewey? Stephen Fassmeyer, you wrote the book Dewey. Who was he?
Well, the most popular Dewey right now was not the Dewey Decimal guy. His name is Melville, by the way. I heard he was a seventh cousin of John, but I have no idea. But Dewey the library cat apparently is very popular. So it's not him, not Admiral George Dewey, who was born in Montpelier. Then there was the Dewey defeats Truman guy, right, of the 1948 Chicago troop. Yeah, not him. So this Dewey, as you said, was born in Burlington, Vermont, and indeed was born on Willard Street. There's a historical marker there. And he was born October 20th, 1859. So his birthday will be next week. Archibald and Lucina Dewey were the parents. And five blocks away from there, he was buried. He died in 1952, so I like to say he didn't make it very far, about five blocks. But most of his life, he lived in New York City, and before that, Chicago, University of Chicago, and Columbia University. But he's the most cited academic philosopher of the 20th century. He made arguably the most significant contribution to educational thinking in the 20th century, and he approached philosophy as a necessity, not a luxury, for interpreting a culture, evaluating it, criticizing it, and hopefully redirecting it. And he thought philosophy really mattered when it helps us to deal with the difficulties that we share and when it extends and deepens the sort of experiences that we find to be most worthwhile.
Jonathan Miller Lane, do you find that people often don't know a lot about John Dewey?
Yes, in the world of education, and particularly if you've been through the sort of world of teacher education, folks know about John Dewey. So in that world, he's well known and he's well regarded and he's used. But outside of that world, he is little known. It's true.
Well, why do you think that is? I mean, if people who know him say this was perhaps the most American philosopher or most important American philosopher of the 20th century and late 19th century, if not ever, why isn't he somebody who's held up more prominently?
I think his ideas are actually, once you start to work with them, far more radical than people realize. And so if you actually start to work with what he suggested we do, you suddenly encounter very complicated, very interesting, profound commitments to democratic life. And I think there's still a great debate in the country about what schools are for. What really are schools for? Dewey had very specific ideas about that that were really fundamentally grounded on the development of individual human beings. You know, that democracy is a way of life and education is a process of living, not preparation for future living. But not everyone agrees. So once you get into it, the debates get quite serious, I think, and there's a lot of disagreement.
Although it would seem that in our current culture anyway, that would be more exciting to people to have somebody who could be a flashpoint.
Yes, it would be if you're willing to play in that, I like to call it the Dewey sandbox. But very often I think people sort of like to imagine that they're interested in the ideas, but to actually work with them and start to imagine every classroom being a place that was this alive with the kinds of interaction Dewey talked about require really demanding teaching. They require careful preparation and really, like democracy itself, a certain tolerance for creative chaos rather than incoherent chaos.
That was Professor Stephen Fessmeyer of Green Mountain College and Jonathan Miller Lane of Middlebury College talking with Jane about John Dewey. One Vermonter who absolutely embraces the creative chaos of Dewey's ideas is Frank Gonzalez. Frank is an artist and teacher who might be John Dewey's biggest fan. He started Burlington's annual Dewey Day Parade, in which a 10-foot Dewey puppet is marched up and down Church Street. I caught up with Frank at the Fletcher Free Library in Burlington, where he was leading a mask-making workshop for children before the parade. He showed me the big puppet and talked a little about what Dewey means to him.
I'm Frank Gonzalez. Well, first I have to say that I was born and raised in Pasadena, California, and I was placed in a John Dewey program for 3 years, and I didn't know how much it affected me until I began to work with children. He brought the idea that we are all individuals uniquely, we are born, and that education should be to develop that uniqueness. And this way, we respect the differences in each other, and we can learn from each other. And all these wars that we've been through and still are into, they haven't learned that. And that's why it's important that children in preschool learn that and carry it with them for the rest of their lives. Of course, when I discovered that John Dewey was born here in Burlington, I thought, whoa, I've got to find out about this man. So I went where he was born, began to read his works, and I thought, I owe you, John Dewey. So I thought we should do a parade. Because even today, you mention the name Dewey, and people say, oh, yeah, the decimal Dewey. Well, he also left a legacy, but that's Melville Dewey. So I'm going to keep beating the drum because so many people still don't know the importance of his legacy. This is John Dewey, made with rolled up newspapers, like these that I have in my hand. I was in the Army during the war, and after that, I was so sick and tired of what was happening with McCarthyism, the Cold War, and so forth. So I thought, I'm getting out of here. And I thought I'd go to Brazil, but I only got as far as Mexico. And there I married and had two sons and made a lot of discoveries there. And that's where I got the idea of rolling up newspapers into tubes when I taught architectural design at the university. And I was amazed at how strong you could make them. And that's, he could be worn, actually. You wear them on your shoulders, and we would see your feet barely there. This would have a section cut out so you could see where you're going. And then there'd be people attached, one with each arm, and a pole so they could lift it up and he could wave as we walked in the parade. Well, I was in the Army for 3 years, and I learned a lot from that. And when I came back, I thought, we have to beat the drum and help people understand that they are unique and they have creative juices inside that they could allow to be free.
That was educator and artist Frank Gonzalez talking about philosopher John Dewey. Thanks for joining us today. Tomorrow, you'll hear some of Jane's favorite stories of the year, including segments on cartooning and free speech, tracking bears, and laughing babies. Vermont Edition is produced by Rick Singeri and me, Sam Gail Rosen. It's hosted by Jane Lindholm and Bob Kinzel. Special thanks to our terrific digital team here at VPR, Emily Alphen Johnson, Jonathan Butler, Angela Evansy, and Sarah Simon. Our executive producer is Patty Daniels. Thanks for listening.